This is Speaking of Purpose, where we talk to real people making real change. Today, we're taking a peek behind the curtain at how companies set bold impact goals and how they achieve those goals and measure them. In 2016, at the direction of Cisco's CEO, Chuck Robbins, the company set an audacious goal to positively impact 1 billion lives by 2025. Chiru Adesnik, executive director of the Cisco Foundation, took up the challenge, and with the help of partners and employees, delivered on the goal more than 1 year early. Now, she's helping Cisco answer the question, after achieving such a bold goal, where does the company go from there?
Welcome, Chiru.
Thank you so much for having me, Sona.
Great to have you. So we'd love for you to kick off this conversation by telling us a little bit about the Cisco Foundation, your role and the work that you do there.
Yeah, so Cisco is a company celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. The Cisco Foundation was founded early on. It was a foresight of our former CEO, John Morgridge, at a time when the tech sector was booming, but he sort of had the foresight and recognized that there will always be a need. And so the Cisco Foundation was established a few years after Cisco started as a public company. And our vision really is to catalyze a vibrant ecosystem of change makers and support the nonprofit sector and nonprofits in the sector toward resilience and thriving communities.
Beautiful. And what's your role there?
So I'm the executive director, and I have a bit of a dual role. I lead the Cisco Foundation, which is a separate legal entity from Cisco. We are a grant-making foundation with a few different cash grant programs and then a climate impact investment initiative. And then on the corporate side of the house, I lead our social innovation investments team. And between the company and the foundation, we provide support to nonprofit organizations that work with economically underserved communities. And we always look to bring the best of Cisco and the most of Cisco. So we donate Cisco and Splunk technology. That's really about helping to ensure that organizations are able to securely connect and deliver their programs and services. Cash grant programs between the Cisco Foundation and the company. And then we also spend a fair amount of our time, both my team and Cisco employees, providing strategic advice, pro bono consulting services to our nonprofit partners.
Sounds like an incredible role. So let's travel back in time to almost a decade ago, Chiru. In 2016, Cisco made a bold commitment. You said that you would positively impact 1 billion lives by 2025. So can you tell us who set this goal and why?
Yeah, and it was an interesting endeavor. Chuck Robbins became our CEO in the fall of 2015. And I still remember the first company meeting. He was talking about his view for the broader business, but also talked about our purpose work, our corporate responsibility work. And there was a lot of enthusiasm. And so we all wanted to tap into that and, set this ambitious goal that we wanted to positively impact 1 billion people by 2025. I wish I could say we knew right then how we would get there. We did not. There were a lot of learnings along the way. But we did it through actually two initiatives. One was our Cisco Networking Academy, which is our flagship purpose program launched over 25 years ago. And it's where we partner with universities, community colleges, nonprofit organizations to deliver tech curriculum. And then the other was our Global Cash Grant program, which is underwritten by the Cisco Foundation and our corporate cash grant program. So that was sort of the genesis of how it all came about. We wanted to put a big stake in the ground and tap into those offerings and see if we could positively impact 1 billion people around the world in multiple sectors.
And so not every company is, purpose-driven from the top down, like what you just described. I'm curious a bit about why this deep commitment to purpose is so important to Cisco.
You know, it goes back to our founding with John Morgridge. It was embedded from the very beginning and carried through to John Chambers, who is the next CEO, and now, with Chuck. It's always been a core part of our DNA, not just here in Silicon Valley in California, where we're based. But as we grew as a company beyond this area, beyond the United States, it's always been, you know, critical from the top down and frankly from the bottom up, whether it's executives or frontline employees. You know, we also have, as you know, Sona, and you've talked about with our team and with Brian, you know, we have a goal of engaging 80% of our employees in giving back, whether it's donations or volunteering. And so it's always been just a core part of who we are and what we do.
And those are the kinds of companies I find that end up making the biggest impact because of the sustained commitment, unwavering commitment. It's a part of who you are. So to not do it would be out of character. I really appreciate that about Sysco. You can feel that it's deeply authentic. So let's dive into this, you know, 1 billion lives positively impacted, because I think you alluded to the fact that it was not a straightforward journey, that there were lots of learnings. So let's go through that journey together. I want to start with just asking you how you determined what would even count as a life positively impacted.
That's right. And, you know, we worked with PricewaterhouseCoopers once we were a few years into the process, and had them validate and externally assure both our methodology and the actual numbers. And, you know, we were very deliberate. We did not say we want to reach 1 billion people. We said we wanted to positively impact. So what does positive impact look like? And it varies by sector. The three sectors that we looked at were crisis response and critical human needs, education, and economic empowerment. So for us, you know, determining what is positive impact and the point at which you can say someone has been positively impacted was really critical. So as an example, if we are funding through a grant program, a nonprofit partnership that's working with smallholder farmers, we want to see that those farmers are seeing increases in productivity, that they're seeing increases in yield size, that they're seeing increases in revenue, and that it's then translating to improved household security. Maybe they're saving more. Maybe they're able to send their child to school, or they're able to, you know, fix the roof on their house, but really looking at that end impact. Similarly, if it's an education program working in schools, we want to see that children are engaging with curriculum, that they're showing an increase or in expanded interest and persistence in STEM. And then, of course, student outcomes. Are we seeing measurable progress and increases in the rates of proficiency in science, technology, engineering, math, literacy? And then for economic empowerment, you know, let's say it's a skilling program. We want to see that not only are people signing up to take a training program, but that they're completing that training program, that we're seeing increases in their levels of proficiency and their skills, that they're going on to get jobs that provide stable and thriving wages, and that they're able to increase, move toward economic security and independence. So that was sort of how we thought about what does positive impact look like? And most importantly, you know, when can we be sure that that positive impact has actually occurred? So it goes much further than, you know, a light touch or reaching people to engaging and then seeing what those actual outcomes and impacts look like.
Yeah, I'm struck by the depth. And, you know, it's not just a feel-good metric. There's actual outcomes that you're describing, Charu. These are obviously outcomes that are not common in the business world, right? Like, you know, we're used to your traditional business KPIs. So I'm a little bit curious about how you convinced senior executives across the business, if you even had to accept these goals when, you know, these types of impact goals don't always map neatly to those traditional business KPIs that I referenced earlier.
You know, we didn't have to do much convincing. I think because we have a legacy dating back to the Networking Academy program, which again is, you know, our longest standing CSR and purpose program, we have a lot of great data that we get from that, because that's an initiative that we own and operate in, you know, 200 countries around the world. And so that part wasn't difficult. You know, I think there was always the commitment there. And frankly, you know, our leadership are bought into our premise, with the NetAcad, but also with our cash grant programs, that particularly with the cash grant programs, where with our nonprofit partners, we're investing early stage. We're investing in solutions that are tech-enabled, tech-driven, but may not be proven yet, may not exist yet. And so with that, you know, there's sort of this, we were able to show, I think, frankly, as a result of this 1 billion lives goal, that investment thesis works. Investing early and investing in tech-enabled initiatives, which is high, you know, if you're investing early stage in something that's not proven, it's higher risk, but we found through this that it works. And, you know, we know along the way that we were having traction because we looked at different KPIs and outcomes at each point, right? So in the early stage, it's more you're looking at deliverables. Is the program on track? Sort of that, you know, is there now a solution that exists that did not before? And then you sort of move into that, if we build it, will they come? You know, now you have a solution that exists. Are people availing themselves of it? Are you getting new clients, but also retaining the clients that you have? Are you starting to see that the solution is replicating to other geographies? Is it scaling to reach more people? And then you kind of over time start seeing what that actual, the deeper, longer term social impact is. So I think there was always an appreciation for how we went about this and thinking about what KPIs we want to look at every point in that journey, from early stage to validation to replication and scale and then to graduation.
That's fascinating. I am curious a bit about what it was about this initiative that proved that early stage funding was effective. Were there new kind of insights or because of the long-term nature of it? Or the diligent tracking. Can you share a little bit more about that?
It was all of that. I think, you know, part of what we saw that positive impact at the individual level. Those, you know, end clients or beneficiaries, we were seeing that. But also what we saw more broadly was that more than 70% of the solutions that we've invested in have successfully replicated beyond one country to either multiple countries in a region or across regions. So we see that this investment model is working in that respect around replication. We see that more than 40% of the solutions that we invested in, that again started from just that kernel of an idea, today are reaching 1 million people a year or more. We're seeing that 97% of our partners are telling us that they have been able to unlock additional funding, which they directly attribute to Cisco early stage support. Because most funders are investing in proven solutions. It's lower risk. You see a quicker time horizon for return on investment. But really where that need is in those early stages. And so the fact that once a solution that we're investing in gets to the point that it's proven, we start seeing other funders coming off the sidelines. So I think those are really important learnings for us to see. We're seeing impact at the individual level, but we're also seeing impact at the organization level with replication, with scale. And then in many cases, you know, systems level change where our partners may now be, because the solution is proven and it's starting to scale and replicate, they can forge national level partnerships with the Ministry of Education or, you know, Ministry of Health or whoever it is. And so those were really important learnings for us throughout, you know, even beyond the 1 billion lives, what's happening in the sector, what's happening at a systemic level, you know, in a particular issue area.
Yeah, it's almost like the nitty gritty of it is so much more fascinating than the top line. that's fascinating, Drew. Thank you for sharing that. So it sounds like you had a lot of support, a lot of buy-in, a lot of credibility because of the long-standing nature of the foundation's investments. I do want to come back to a little bit of the tension and impact work and corporate practices. I'm curious about how you might have managed staying focused on this very bold long-term goal and the need to potentially show milestone progress or short-term results to your executive team and shareholders to keep them engaged and confident that you were in fact achieving the goals that you'd set out to achieve.
You know, we provided you know, updates. We track the numbers every year, so we could see on a year-over-year basis that we were making forward progress. And we had said all along, you know, it's 1 billion people over 10 years, but we were not looking to have, you know, an exact number of people positively impacted in each year. We knew that maybe, you know, there would be some years where it would be a big increase and other years where it would be smaller, but we were making steady progress on the numbers. And then, you know, in each case, whether it was with the Networking Academy, where we've got, again, great data there that shows people completing, students completing courses, going on to get jobs, which they attribute back to Cisco, and showing some of the proof points along the way with some of our partnerships, where even if it was early stage, you know, seeing kind of that progress from ideation to now validation to an expanded pilot to scale and replication. So throughout the process each year, you know, we saw many, many examples of that forward progress, either with an organization that we were partnering with the solution itself, so that we could track, okay, are we moving in the right direction? And, you know, at that positive impact level, you know, what is happening? A program is being executed now, but are we seeing that deep engagement with those end beneficiaries or clients?
Interesting. You referenced every year was not the same. And when we think about 2016 to 2025, a lot happened in there, right? There was a pandemic or a racial justice movement, like major macroeconomic volatility, political shifts, geopolitical shifts, polarization. So I could go on and on, environmental disasters, wars and conflicts. How did these dynamics influence the way you pursued your goals and the results? Like, was there a lot of pivoting and adjusting that needed to happen? Because I assume the nonprofits ended up having to pivot and adjust to changing circumstances through that time frame.
Yeah, I don't, you know, we didn't need to make any major adjustments to how we went about, you know, pursuing the goal. But certainly COVID was, you know, something none of us expected. You know, I think credit to the way we kind of invest is trying to be agile and flexible to be able to respond. And so when COVID hit, actually our partners fared really well, our nonprofit partners, because we were already investing in them to support them to leverage technology to deliver their programs and services, right? It wasn't just use of tech, but tech to actually deliver. And so, you know, as one example, with our Skills to Careers partners, you know, they all did a great job adjusting how they delivered the curriculum. Maybe they had to chunk it out into smaller modules. Maybe they had to build in more time for group learnings or one-on-one sessions. Or if it was an organization working with, you know, predominantly women, let's say, they maybe needed to build in more time for childcare, as women, you know, obviously bear the brunt of childcare responsibilities. But, you know, making all of those adjustments, pivoting to how they deliver their offerings, we didn't see a drop off in participation or engagement rates with beneficiaries. We actually saw, in many cases, better levels of engagement by being very focused and customized. And we saw similar, you know, longer term returns where people were still completing the program, still going on to get good jobs that provide stable and sufficient income. You know, in one case, we actually, it helped our partner have more of a regional approach to how they deliver. They were previously working in several different countries, but not really cross-pollinating live. And so they changed how they did their delivery, pivoted to, you know, online delivery, but included people from across multiple countries. So then they were able to get these really interesting cross-country learnings, which they were able to apply across the board. So I think that piece was also very telling for us that, again, investing in technology was the way to reach people. And because our partners were already doing that, it wasn't as heavy a lift for them as I think it was for a lot of other nonprofit organizations. And second, that embracing of technology for the delivery is really what drove us getting to 1 billion people, right? We couldn't get to 1 billion people without using technology, not just to connect the unconnected, but again, to have impact at scale.
Yeah, really interesting how early adoption and incubation of technology can support resilience during
Exactly.
those, during those kind of critical years where everything went haywire. So why don't we dive into the measurement piece? Charu, what kind of metrics have you found actually matter when you're focused on systemic long-term impact and maybe not just short-term, outputs or outcomes?
Yeah, I think, again, it varies by sector, but really looking beyond that, initial reach and light touch to deep engagement, and then seeing some of those longer term outcomes. We know that if we get people to show up for a skilling program and then they complete it, that they value that curriculum or how it's delivered or some combination, right? If you get people that sign up to the training program, but they don't complete it, there's something there. And then you need to kind of refine, retool, either change how you deliver it or change how, change what your approach is. Once you have people completing it, then if you're looking and you see that people are not getting employed, that's telling you something either about the hiring market or about the, the strength of that curriculum. But we've seen in all cases that we are able to show people are coming in, participating, engaging in curriculum, completing the training, and going on to get jobs that provide, thriving wages. And we see people not just kind of getting that first job, but getting a job that then provides career advancement opportunities. So we see people who go through these training programs getting promotions, going from being an entry-level person or being a, project manager to a program manager to a department leader to having, people under them that they're managing. So that's kind of how we approach looking at what that impact is at different levels, right? Again, it's going to be different in the very, very early stage where it's more deliverables based, is the solution now available? And then you start looking at that. What is the value? How are people, the community valuing that solution? And then you start seeing those longer term outcomes and impact.
And Charu, when you selected the grantees, for the cash grant program, for example, did you select them at the outset of the project or the initiative, or were you adding other recipients throughout the 10-year period?
Yeah, we started with a cohort of organizations, but throughout those, 9 years, we were bringing in new partners, others were graduating out. So there's always sort of this what we call a cycle of innovation, where we'll have a cohort of partners as we see them advancing from that blueprint or ideas phase to validation and proof of concept to replication and scale and outcomes, and then graduating. There's constantly a funnel, or we're investing early stage to prime the pump. And then for those that are at that stage where they've validated the solution, how can we really help them now to have that big increase in scale and go from, okay, the solution's now validated, let's ramp up. So that was sort of how we approach it. But there are constantly organizations coming in and out. And again, at that early stage in the first year or so, we wouldn't count numbers because maybe the solution is just being developed, or maybe it's been piloted on a very limited scale, but we're not at that point where we can say that someone has been positively impacted yet. So it's sort of that kind of a cyclical approach where you kind of start low, you invest, you start seeing the results, and then you ramp up very quickly.
And how did you track progress along the way? Were there annual check-ins or quarterly check-ins? I can imagine there was quite a bit of work in just compiling the data and the progress and engaging directly with the nonprofits to understand how things were progressing.
So on the grant side, our portfolio managers do quarterly check-ins. That's something that we, put in place because, again, with us investing earlier stage, it's higher risk. So we want to make sure that the program is on track. And if, unexpected things happen, how can we help, remediate and get things back on track? And so there were quarterly check-ins. And then at the end of each year, each grantee is required to submit, what we call a summary impact report, where they you know, document and provide evidence of the progress that they've made. So, but we are constantly in touch with them. So we kind of have a sense. It's not like you wait till the end of the year and then suddenly you're surprised that things have fallen off the rails. But we do, you know, check in. And then we had sort of that process, the summary report where they submitted their results and evidence. And then that we could use to work with PwC on the annual external assurance that we did.
So here's a big question for you. What did you learn from the process?
You know, I will say the other thing that we did that frankly made it a bit more difficult on ourselves. We also said 1 billion people positively impacted, 1 billion unique people, so not double counted. That, frankly, was the most difficult piece because, you know, we may have either among grantee partners or with the NEDACAD organizations that are operating in the same geography. And it could be that one family benefits from a crisis response program and also is someone in the family is participating in a skilling program. So that was, frankly, the most difficult piece. And, you know, we did it because we didn't want to just say we're impacting the same people year after year. But I think one learning also is for our nonprofit partners, they aren't really looking at impact in that way. And we were really the only funder who was asking them to report in that way. So I think having more flexibility, we want to make sure that, you know, we're reaching people and then increasing the number of people that we're reaching and engaging every year. But for our nonprofit partners, you know, it they just want to impact people. And so part of it is also, you know, there's something to be said about the same household or individual having multiple interventions, right? If you have multiple interventions over a period of time, you can have deeper impact. So I think that was one learning for us. It was important for us to be able to count unique, but there's also something to be said for, and this was the case in many cases where the depth and level of intervention. So I think that would be something that we would want to, you know, in hindsight, draw out both those use cases where we're reaching new people, but also having deep impact on the existing people that we're engaging. I think the second is just how you think about impact evaluation. In, you know, with our Networking Academy program, again, that's a program that we own and operate. But for nonprofit partners, impact evaluation is expensive and it's time consuming. And every funder wants to see impact, but people aren't, you know, funders aren't always willing to invest in that. So we have always said, you know, we will fund a line item in a grant budget to support impact evaluation. We also have, you know, our in-house team who will work with our nonprofit partners to help them think through, you know, what might impact evaluation look like. You know, on the one end, the gold standard obviously is randomized controlled trials. But what are other ways that we can work with you to identify some of those, like we talked about before, some of those interim KPIs that give you a sense of, are you moving in the right direction? Is the trajectory, you know, are you on course? And then see some of that longer term impact. So I think that was another important learning for us, was really investing in nonprofit organizations to support impact evaluation.
And was that based on some of the feedback you got from them? Because I'd love to hear a bit of how nonprofits experienced the whole thing from their perspective. And was there other feedback that they gave to you along the way?
You know, that was something that we were willing to do from the beginning, you know, in having, let's say, a line item and a grant. But I do think what we saw was across the board, I would say for the most part, our grantees were already doing a good job evaluating impact. The level of evidence that we needed from them to support the assurance was kind of a different level. They don't always look at it that way. But there weren't a lot of surprises. It was a lot of, can you help us? You know, you, Cisco, are very focused on impact. So are we. How can we partner together to really look at that depth of impact and that sustained impact over time? So, you know, I also think when we work with a nonprofit organization, we do so much work up front, due diligence on the organization itself, due diligence on the solution, that by the time we get to the point where we're executing a grant, they understand how we think about evaluation and we understand how they think about it. So there weren't really any big surprises in that part of the process of how we, you know, our focus on impact evaluation, our desire to be able to have, you know, rigorous data collection and validation mechanisms.
I can imagine a grantee going through this process with Cisco would come out quite with a pretty high level of competency around measurement and, you know, even just the metrics to be able to show other funders so that it builds a little bit more of a sustainable funding mechanism for them. Is that true?
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, like I said, and you knew this, every funder wants, you know, is talking about impact. We want to see impact. And we know that impact can take several years, right? And that's why we have those interim KPIs. But I think the fact that, you know, many of the partners who actually were selected for testing and went through that process, they said to us, you know, this was certainly not a fun process to be to be audited, but it really helped them and they could make the case, whether it's to their, you know, internal board, to other funders, to people in the community, to the publics. They can communicate that they have been through this process and that, you know, this work validated their impact. So I think that was really good for them. And the fact that we have, you know, 97% of our partners telling us, hey, we were able to unlock additional funding, whether it was from a government entity, from private foundations, from corporate foundations, you know, or increased partnerships, and attributing that to our support, I think that too was really, you know, demonstrated the power of this investment approach and how we approach impact evaluation.
Yeah, that's the gift that keeps on giving. And what you're saying echoes some of the data we've seen, Charu. So we published our State of Corporate Purpose report this year. It's our annual trends report. And what we noted was that measurement reporting have been the fastest growing budget line items two consecutive years. And it now is consuming about a quarter of an impact team's time. What is your opinion around this? Why do you think this is changed? Why there is just so much more investment in, you know, measurement and reporting in the last few years? And what do you think has driven this, you know, acceleration in investment in this area?
I think, you know, as the sector has matured, some of it has been that. I think also some of these reporting and assurance requirements, particularly in Europe, having to get, you know, programs and your claims externally validated. But I think it's been sort of a natural evolution in the sector, going from, you know, showing reach to engagement to impact. That's kind of what I've seen, at least, you know, over the last 10 years, particularly, I would say, the last 3, 4, 5 years. And I think, you know, with COVID, as organizations were responding to increased demand in the sector and funders were, you know, potentially increasing their funding, really looking for who can we, you know, as funders, we also have to demonstrate to our leadership, you know, these investments are worthwhile. We are seeing actual results. So being able to justify that internally and going beyond the, you know, it's a nice thing to do to, This is supporting people and communities in need, but also reflects back on our business, whether it's, you know, around brand and reputation or thought leadership or, you know, opening doors, building relationships in current or new markets. It's really just, I think, been a natural evolution of the sector.
Yeah, I think it's a positive sign of this level of sophistication that the discipline has realized. Even though it's been around for a long time, but I think, you know, between technology and just the level of investment that companies make in these teams, even, it's all been able to change. And I think it's positive. I think it's hard, but I think it's positive. And I think it'll actually build a much more sustainable investment over the long term. So let's go back to the moment that you realized you were about to hit this audacious goal. Can you tell us a bit about what that picture looked like? Tell us what it was, how you shared the news, what the reaction was.
Yeah, I vividly remember we were getting in our data. We knew we were largely on track, but we were getting our data back in, going through and validating it. And I remember I was, you know, I was working from home and I, you know, was looking around like, there's nobody for me to, you know, jump up and down and shout with. But yeah, it was very exciting when we got the final sign off from PwC on our numbers, you know, the year before, and then added these numbers on, you know, sharing it with our leadership team, sharing it with the team of people who worked on this, you know, over the course of many years. And really, the team is what drove that. And then our nonprofit partners, you know, they were the ones who did the hard work. And so being able to share that was really, you know, we exceeded the goal, 1.1 billion people. We did it a year early. And we had those the results and the methodology externally assured. So that was it was fantastic. And then when our CEO announced it at a company meeting, we were all just thrilled.
Oh, that's wonderful. Those are incredible moments to be a part of something. Because after 10 years, you know, like you said, it's a significant investment in time. And but also like that is your day-to-day work, but your soul work. As you're like, you're pouring your heart and soul into this over and over. So it's pretty incredible.
That's right. Especially from when we started, when we, you know, we had a plan, but weren't exactly sure how we were going to get there.
Yeah, right. And to actually get there is phenomenal. So it has been a few years since you met your goal. I'd love to just take a moment to reflect. Looking back, Charu, what stands out to you most about the lasting effect of setting this bold milestone and achieving it?
You know, a few things. One, I think, you know, being able to show that the impact at that very granular level with 1 billion people, but also the impact that I think we can say we've had on the sector with our grantee partners. Those organizations are all, you know, we still track some of them. We continue to invest in some of them. They continue to innovate. They continue to scale to reach more people. They continue to replicate to other countries and geographies. So the work certainly hasn't stopped. I think that is a lasting legacy. This what we've seen happen at a sector level with some of our partners, again, who are now working, you know, forging MOUs. They've been able to take the funding that we provided and the advice that we provided in our technology that we donated and prove that case, which has helped them unlock partnerships at a national level. And again, I think that the focus on both the scale of reach and the depth of impact is really what opened doors for them with other funders, with government entities. So now we're seeing programs that maybe just started in one city or county or municipality or province, you know, being taken up and adopted by government entities. And so then you also see that co-funding coming in and seeing additional sources of revenue, because again, we take that venture capital approach where we invest early on, we continue to support, but we want to see that path to graduation or exit, and to know that we have helped support, build the capacity of those organizations and invest in those solutions so that they can carry on, you know, long after our, you know, engagement ends. And so it's also really about building capacity. And we intentionally look for organizations that are proximate, that are hiring locally, whose management and staff are based and hired locally. One, it ensures that you have a really proximate and community-centric approach, and the organizations we're partnering with are embedded locally so they can, you know, ideate and design solutions with those communities that they're hoping to, you know, drive positive impact, but also for that longevity and building the capacity of those organizations and creating jobs locally. Those are two huge takeaways for us, because, you know, we didn't want it to be something where you have people just flying in, working on a solution, and then when the program's over, it's just done, right? And so this way of having sustained, meaningful impact, long-term viability, I think that was another big learning for us, that this investment model does support that.
Sounds truly catalytic.
We felt like it was. I mean, again, this is, you know, a testament to the investment model, but really the hard work of all of our partners and how they are approaching the work that they're doing in these communities, with a really sort of thoughtful, holistic, and again, proximate approach.
And so is there something you would have done differently looking back now?
You know, I think we would have, the main thing would be kind of looking at both that unique number of people positively impacted, but also trying to draw in more of the other offerings that we can bring to the table at Cisco. And that's actually what we're looking to do with our next big ambition. You know, this program, we were thrilled to be able to have such deep impact at scale. And it was literally through those two initiatives, the Networking Academy and One Grant Program. There's so much more that Cisco can bring to the table. And that's what we're looking to do now.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You have just launched your next bold ambition for Cisco's 40th anniversary, supporting 40 local communities around the world in the next 10 years. It seems as though you've kind of gone from this wide and all-compassing goal to something very specific and localized. Tell us a bit about that evolution, Charu.
Yeah, and so as we, you know, when we exceeded the 1 billion goal and we started to think, you know, what next? A couple things came to mind. One was, okay, we know that this way of working works, but how can we bring in more of what Cisco has to offer? So more, you know, we didn't include any of our technology donations in the goal, but how can we really leverage our technology? How can we bring in other initiatives like our country digitization acceleration program, which is a program that is operating in 50 countries around the world, where we partner at a government level to digitize services. How can we leverage our government affairs partners to work with government entities? And really, if we bring all of this and focus it on communities and address sort of systemically with an integrated approach, how can we have much deeper impact in a specific community? You know, there are a lot of companies that have place-based strategies, and we're learning a lot from that. We want to be a collaborator in this ecosystem, working with other companies, with government entities, with nonprofits, with academia, to really co-design, jointly design and execute programs. And again, similar focus on capacity building, because as new communities come in, others will graduate and exit out. We want to similarly, with our 1 billion lives goal, make sure that there's capacity to have sustained, meaningful, long-term impact. And so that was, you know, one approach was having kind of a holistic, integrated way of going into a community. So as opposed to having, you know, different piecemeal projects, just going in with that holistic integrated approach and doing it very collaboratively. And I think particularly now, with funding becoming more and more squeezed around the world, it's more and more important for us to collaborate. And, you know, we know there are so many companies working on similar issues that we are: skilling, particularly cybersecurity and AI, right? Small and medium businesses, which are, you know, the largest job creators in most locations. So how can we come in holistically, but also with a very deep partnership approach and working, again, you know, proximate, community-centric, to jointly ideate, align on, and tackle challenges?
Really exciting. We wish you the best of luck, and we'll be tracking your progress, and hopefully we'll get to hear how it's going and have you back on the podcast so you can share more.
Absolutely.
So we're coming up to the end of our time, Charu, and I have one final question for you. This podcast is called Speaking of Purpose, and we want you to have the last word on the podcast. So we're going to ask you, what about this topic needs to be said?
I would say, you know, getting back to collaboration, you know, again, with funding getting squeezed in so many places around the world and the need still being very high, there's still so much we need to do. Collaborate, you know, between companies, collaborating within the nonprofit sector. We have some of our partners who are participating in roundtables that we host, and we're seeing them partnering with each other more closely. I think with funding drying up, we will see more consolidation and mergers in the sector, and that's not a bad thing. But just how can we partner together to have deeper impact and to have impact at scale? I think that for me is kind of the big takeaway. We all talk about collaborating. We all want to do it. We're all there with the good intentions. We're not always great about it. But I think now more than ever, the time is right. And we really need to be collaborating more across the board.
That's fantastic. I think we can look to Cisco to lead the way on that. Thank you so much, Charu, for your time today.
Thanks so much for tuning in. Make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to hear more stories of real people making real change. Till next time.